You might think Grammarly is a fancy spell check, but your team has been using and loving it for years because it does way more than you realize. Grammarly's AI can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.
This week on the podcast, I have an extra special guest. His name is Scott Cooper, and he is the managing partner at Andreessen Horowitz, one of the most storied venture capital firms in Silicon Valley. You know all the companies they've invested in. I'm not going to give you a list here. Scott is an unusual guy because not only did he go to Stanford undergrad and law school, so he has that legal background. He understands both the deal side, the finance side, and the tech side. He's really a triple threat, and he discusses the things that any entrepreneur or theoretically anybody who wants to be a limited partner in a venture capital firm should know. If you are at all interested in technology, startups, VC funding, you are going to find this conversation to be absolutely delightful. So with no further ado, my conversation with Andreessen Horowitz's Scott Cooper.
This is Masters in Business with Barry Ritholtz on Bloomberg Radio.
My special guest today is Scott Cooper. He graduated from Stanford undergrad and law school. He was employee number one at Andreessen Horowitz, the famed venture capital firm where he is currently managing partner. The fund runs $7 billion and has been early investors in such startups as Facebook, Groupon, Twitter, Airbnb, Slack, Stripe, Skype, and many others. His new book is The Secrets of Sand Hill Road. Scott Cooper, welcome to Bloomberg.
Thank you for having me.
So I've been looking forward to having this conversation. You are the third Andreessen Horowitz veteran willing to suffer my slings and arrows.
Right. What does that say about us? Right?
Well, it says that you're pretty hip, you get podcasts, and you understand having people ask you interesting questions and coming up with interesting answers. So let's start with a little bit about your background. Professionally, you were kind of born right into the bubble. That's how you describe yourself in the book. You led the IPO for Opsware in 01. What was it like going public right in the middle of the collapse?
It was an amazing, amazing time. So you're right. I was actually an investment banker before I went to Opsware. And by the way, Opsware was LoudCloud at that time, which was the predecessor in 2001.
Right. So just a little background. Yeah. LoudCloud was set up to be the original
Amazon
apps
Web
in
Services,
the cloud. Right.
Yeah. Basically, that's what we were trying to do.
10 years earlier.
Right? Yeah. Yes.
And then at a certain point, that pivoted to... You had developed your own software, operational software.
Correct.
And that's
right,
said,
exactly.
Hey, other companies are going to need this. So you took an in-house technology similar to what Amazon is doing with LoudCloud, AWS,
yeah.
And you spun it out as a separate, fully separate entity.
That's exactly right. So LoudCloud started in 1999. So it was, you know, perfect timing, right? We raised a ton of money. We hired a bunch of people. And then, of course, the market turned in a different direction. So we took it public in 2001, actually, for the very honest reason, which was that was the best source of capital at the time. So
Right. There
was no other, you know, viable source or attractive source of capital. And I think we were one of actually two IPOs that happened that year.
In 01, yeah, not, what was it, 500 in 2000 or
99? Yeah, so there was about 750 or so between the 2 years of 99 and 2000.
Wow.
And then basically, I think there were two. In 2001, us and a company called Storage Networks, I think, was the other one that went out that year.
So eventually, the company gets bought by Hewlett Packard.
That's right.
And what was that? So the people who are still there as employees, What was that transition like? What was your role? You're an attorney. What was your role in the acquisition?
It was fun. So my main role was actually to run the integration between the two companies. So we kind of had, there was an executive on our side who was me, and then there was an executive on the HP side. And basically our job was, okay, we're doing this deal. What is this going to look like as a combined entity? You know, who's going to have jobs in what places? How do we get everything from IT systems integrated? How do we talk to customers? And it was a fun, it was actually a really fun opportunity. And, you know, it was just a different, it was just different from anything I'd ever been through, right? So, you know, I'd always been in the startup community, and then we go into this behemoth HP, and, you know, they've got these playbooks basically about how you do this integration. And, you know, what we tried to help them understand was, look, all that stuff's important. The most important thing, though, is what are you going to tell the employees about who has jobs, what those jobs are going to be, you know, where they're going to show up on day one to go to work. And so there was kind of a human element of it that was, you know, a little bit underserved in the HP side, notwithstanding the fact that they were really good at the systems integration piece.
So, but the assumption is the Opsware employees who may have seen their jobs cut, they still had pretty nice stock options and a nice bump.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, okay, I'm cut loose. Now I could go do my next gig.
That's right. And for most people had a job opportunity to go to HP because HP was really buying this as a growth opportunity. It wasn't like an acquisition where, you know, they're like, look, let's just chop 50% of the people and you know, and create some cash. So most people, you know, maybe there were probably some people in like organizations like finance where obviously it's hard sometimes to have roles that are duplicate between organizations.
Right.
But anybody who was in a product or engineering or a sales-facing role, all those people had the opportunity to stay, and most of them did.
So you come from a legal background, you're running operations at a technology company.
Yep.
How did the transition to venture capital come about? Was it just lucky coincidence you were working with two guys named Andreessen Horowitz?
Well, there was certainly an element of that for sure. So I've been working, you know, with these guys now for almost 10 years when we started the firm, because this year actually will be my 20th year working with them.
Really? That's
which
pretty
is,
good.
You know, that's probably a... just makes me a glutton for punishment. I'm not quite sure what to make of that.
I've been to your office, and I have to say, that looks like a fun place to work.
It is a fun place to work, yeah. No, it's been a great place, and, you know, we've grown it from, there were literally three of us when we started 10 years ago. We've now got 170 employees, so it's been a fun place. But yeah, look, I think the answer to your question is, it was a little bit of, Mark and Ben and I had always, just as I'd had career discussions with them when we were at LoudCloud and Opsware, I'd always said, hey, look, doing something like this someday would be fun. I didn't think about us starting a firm, but I said, gee, that's a kind of business that I think could be fun. And what happened was after we sold the business, the two of them started doing angel investing with their own money. So they were just investing out of their own checkbooks on some deals.
Meaning there's a windfall when the company is sold. They weren't billionaires, but they certainly made you know, tons of money.
Yeah, they did fine. Yeah.
And Mark, so the idea of taking, I'm going to pull $50 million aside and find, you know, 100 companies that could use $500,000 each.
Yeah, it was actually, it was even smaller than that, though. It was literally, they were writing $100,000 checks.
Right.
So it was very kind of small stuff.
And you, by the way, you as a lawyer and an operations guy, I could see you looking at this and gnashing your teeth and saying, where are the capital controls? How is it structured? Where's the paperwork? Like, I barely know you, and I could tell that setup made you crazy.
I feel like you're unfairly typecasting me.
But am I right?
A little bit. They did, the truth be told, look, they did the angel investing on their own. You know, I kind of came into the picture later as we started talking about the fund and the firm itself.
Right.
You know, I inherited a lot of that paperwork, of course.
Why did you write this book, and who is it for?
Yeah, so as we talked about, I've been doing tech stuff for about 25 years now. I was a banker, actually. We never got to that, but I was a banker
tech
even
stuff.
Before.
Tech stuff, is that a technical term?
Exactly. Tech, things in the tech industry. Sorry, maybe I can be more eloquent.
Gotcha.
But, you know, now having been in this business for 10 years, I continue to get a series of questions from entrepreneurs all the time.
Same questions.
Yeah, most of which I thought were answered. You know, kind of, you know, stuff like, look, should I even raise venture capital? Like, how does the business work? And a lot of them have this undertone of, you know, to a certain extent, how do I avoid getting screwed by the venture capitalists? I mean, I hate to say it that way, but that's kind of the way it was. And
are you implying your brethren are rapacious out there? Is that the implication?
No, I think the implication is there's just not a level playing field from an information perspective, right?
Well, so information asymmetry is a problem.
That's right. So look, we'll do, you know, we've been doing this for 10 years. You know, we've done thousands of deals, you know, and repeat entrepreneur maybe does this 5, 6, 7 times over the course of their life. And so there's just stuff that we know and we see because we see it on an everyday basis. And so the purpose of the book in my mind was, look, if we could demystify that and hopefully level the playing field, then maybe it helps have a better relationship between entrepreneurs and VCs. And maybe it even helps people who wouldn't have otherwise thought about entrepreneurship come into the business.
Huh. Interesting. And I have to ask, for the uninitiated, what is Sand Hill Road? I've been there.
Yeah.
I understand it as a concept.
Yeah. The concept at a high level is like, you know, what Wall Street is to financial services, or what, you know, Music Row is to Nashville country music, right?
Mm-hmm.
It literally is a road. It is a street. It is very unexciting, as you've probably seen when you've been there. It's a bunch of kind of, you know, fairly drab two-story buildings.
You have a very nice waterfall that
we do have. That's true.
We
are lucky to have kind of water effect outside our building, mm-hmm. But you know, it just happens to be the locus where all the venture capitalists have established themselves. And I think it's really the answer for that is because of its proximity to Stanford. So the more important part of Sand Hill Road is when you go down Sand Hill Road east, you know, about a mile and a half, you end up on the Stanford campus. And it really does, I think, illustrate the kind of tight connectedness that's always happened between Stanford and the venture and the startup communities.
Right. You see it in Boston between MIT and
that's
Harvard.
That's exactly right. It's like going
and
to
all
Kendall
the biological
Square, right?
Sciences.
Yeah, right. You go to Kendall Square in Cambridge, it's the same kind of thing, right?
A really interesting concept. So one of your chapters is titled The Art of the Pitch. Explain what that is.
Yeah. So we see lots of pitches, as you can imagine, probably about 2,000, 2,500 a year.
Really?
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It's a lot, yeah. So the art of the pitch is really about kind of making sure the pitch is going to resonate with the audience. And I think key to that is to understanding what is it that venture capitalists care about? What is it that they are incented to do? And therefore, how are they going to evaluate you?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think the first thing to think about is the most important thing to think about in this business is we are wrong more often than we're right, which I know is a terrible thing to say. And if your kids came home and got, you know, 50% on their test, you'd be pretty unhappy. If you're doing that in venture capital, you're still in the game at least.
And as long as you bring up that batting average,
yeah.
Why does the hit-miss ratio not matter as much in venture capital as it does elsewhere?
Because if we do it right, then the reason it doesn't matter is because 10 to 20% of the companies, hopefully, if we do it right, you're going to earn 25, 50, 100 times your money. And so basically think of it as, you know, the significant winners will basically make up for, you know, kind of that 50% of things where you won't get your money back, and then probably the 20, 30% where you get a little bit of money back, but not enough to make the math work.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you think about that, then what that means is if I'm going to invest in a company today, I've got to at least believe it has a chance to be one of those 10 or 20% winners. Now, you know, we wish we were smart enough to know exactly which ones they were, and of course, we would just invest in those companies. But we have to at least believe the kind of the ground rules and the opportunity exists. And so that really kind of leads into the art of the pitch about how to frame the pitch in that context.
So from your perspective, what becomes more important, to cast a wide net or to be able to do a deeper dive into a narrower niche where you feel like you have some expertise and some ability to separate the good from the great?
Yeah, I think it's probably somewhere in between, which mm-hmm. is you got to have some number of deals just because you're building a portfolio. So unless you think you're, you know, going to bat a much higher batting average, you at least need some diversification, but that diversification needs to be in domains that you understand. So the way we run our business is we've got vertical domains. So we've got kind of consumer, enterprise, financial services, mm-hmm. life sciences. We've got a bunch of domains, and we staff them with people who are super deep in those domains. And so within those areas, you know, they will go very deep, but then collectively as part of a portfolio, you get the diversification associated with, you know, the multi-dimensions.
So here's a data point from the book that blew my mind. Quote, venture capital is not an especially good investment. As of 2017, 10-year returns for venture capital in the aggregate, not specific funds, but in the aggregate, was 160 basis points below the NASDAQ. So for $8, I could have gone out and bought the QQQs.
Yep.
And outperformed the average of VCs.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
It is amazing. And it's a weird asset class in that regard, which is the variance between good performance and bad performance is really high, like sometimes as much as, you know, almost 3,500 or 4,000 basis points, right? So 35 to 40% return difference. And I think it's a function of the fact that most of this business is largely a zero-sum game in each round of financing. And what I mean by that is if we do the A round, which is kind of the first institutional uh-huh. round for a deal, generally that means, you know, we're the only ones who do that. There might be some other people, but usually one venture firm will be the major, major investor there. And once that opportunity is done, there will never be another A round in Facebook, for example, right? So, you know, Excel, who's a, you know, very good firm, invests in the A round of Facebook. The next opportunity that somebody had to invest was at some multiple evaluation,
sure.
much higher than that. So those still turned out to be obviously very good investments. But there is this kind of nature that, you know, when a round happens, it often accrues to one individual or one firm. And then, you know, kind of things, you know, fundraise every 18 or 24 months. And so the next investor obviously always comes in at a higher price.
So when I look at the world of stocks or mutual funds, it's a sort of Gaussian bell curve
exactly,
distribution
right. yeah.
where, you know, the extremes on either end, get rid of them, there's a big fat distribution in the middle. What you're describing doesn't sound like that.
That's exactly right. So, you know, the term that you may hear people use is kind of called a power law curve, right? And what a power law curve is you've got a very small number of
fat head, long tail.
That's exactly right. You got a few things that drive all the return, then you got this long tail of a bunch of stuff that, quite frankly, doesn't amount to much from a returns perspective.
And we see the same thing in private equity and hedge funds as well.
It is funny, though, actually, you know, you mentioned kind of the public markets. It's actually interesting. There's been a bunch of studies, though, of late on the public markets, which is, it turns out, they actually are more power law than I think people understand.
I think the number is 4% of stocks drive pretty much.
I think that's exactly
all
right.
All the 90% of the returns out there. It's, so good luck picking those four.
Exactly.
If you have a time machine, it's really easy.
Exactly right, yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the changes that you've witnessed in the industry. In the book, you talk about why Combinator and why that was so influential and really changed the game for the VC world. Explain to the layperson what Y Combinator is and why did it matter so much?
Yeah, so Y Combinator is what we call an incubator, which means they basically kind of take usually a cohort of companies. It can be anywhere from 30, 50, sometimes as big as 100 companies. And they kind of, they basically start their business inside of Y Combinator. They go, that's where they go to work. They work on a project. They build a product. They get tutorials and kind of, you know, kind of tutelage from other people. And then they kind of pop out the other end, and hopefully they're ready to go raise, you know, money as a result of that. So it's kind of, you know, almost a finishing school to a certain extent to kind of get the startups ready to kind of be into the regular financing world.
Now, Andreessen was an investor in Y Combinator or an investor in Y Combinator's fund?
In Y Combinator's companies directly, actually. So a couple of years ago when we first started, kind of I think from 2010 to 2012, when companies would go into Y Combinator, they would get some money. We were one of a few firms that used to give them some money. So we would invest small amounts, $25,000, $50,000.
But in lots of different companies.
Yeah, we didn't have discretion at that point in time. It's like, look, everybody who comes in, you're entitled to take this money if you want it. And then obviously, look, if we, you know, if we really were interested in the company, we could put more money in later in a normal financing round.
So why did they change the entire, what did set of, you mentioned earlier, there's an information asymmetry between the seasoned VCs and the young kids running these startups. How did this level the playing field? Did they just kind of learn the ropes?
It's really interesting what happened. So I think the way to think about VC is the first 35, 40 years of VC, call it kind of early 1970s to about 2005, which is when Y Combinator started. You know, you can think about it as capital was a scarce resource. The VCs had it. And therefore, if you looked at the power dynamic, kind of the VCs had the power and the entrepreneurs had less power.
They were the gatekeeper.
If you wanted the money, you had to go to Sand Hill Road and you had to go get the money, right?
Right.
And two big things happened. One is YC, which we'll come back. Sorry, that's short for Y Combinator. And then the second is the amount of money that it required to start a business continued to fall pretty precipitously starting in kind of late 90s and, you know, still continuing to today, right? So, you know,
so fiber optics, cloud, all that stuff meant that
bandwidth, storage,
you didn't
servers.
Need a whole team and a giant server farm. You needed two guys and a laptop, pretty much is
and
what
you
it
go
looked
to,
like.
Now you can go to Amazon Web Services, of course, and get stuff that used to cost you $5 or $10 million of capital expenditures years ago. I mean, when we were in LoudCloud, that's basically what we did. We raised money from the venture capitalists, and we basically then handed it over to companies that nobody remembers anymore, Sun Microsystems. We bought servers from, you know, Oracle databases. You know, all that stuff now you basically get in a box on demand from Amazon for, you know, $10 a gig or whatever the price
is. It's amazing the changes that have taken
place. So what happened was, right, that started to happen, which meant you could now start companies for a lot less money. And therefore, a lot of these seed firms that we're now seeing kind of came into the mix. So we've seen a lot of new seeds. In fact, something like 500 new firms over the last 10 years have come into the seed market.
As companies seeding startups.
Exactly right. So kind of firms like us, firms like Andreessen Horowitz, but just kind of smaller versions of it, right? So $100 million funds instead of $700 or $1 billion funds.
Right.
So you have kind of that phenomenon, right, which is the amount of capital goes down. And then you have the second phenomenon, which is why Combinator comes along and says, hey, we're going to try to actually really, quite frankly, educate a lot of entrepreneurs about the whole startup process. And so take a little bit what was a very black box process and hopefully, you know, open the kimono a little bit. And
that changed that information asymmetry.
That started to change that information asymmetry. And so that really changed the competitive dynamics in this business, because it used to be that if you were a traditional $250 million venture capital firm in this business, you were the first money in, right? So you kind of controlled access to that. Now you're living in an environment where capital is plentiful. You know, you're no longer the gatekeeper for capital. And oh, by the way, there's these 500 new firms that are being started that are kind of upstream of you, right? They're building a relationship with the entrepreneur before you. And then there's this kind of behemoth called Y Combinator that's also kind of effectively now becoming a gatekeeper, right? Because they are kind of a funnel through which a lot of these companies flow. And so the net of both of those is it really just started to dramatically change the environment for venture capital. And that was the opportunity that we saw when we started Andreessen Horowitz in 2009, was to take advantage of that kind of changing of the guard.
So are these seed funds and YC, is this changing the quantity of new startups? Is it impacting the quality? Are we diluting the talent? Or is it just, nope, it's a fire hose and the more the merrier?
Yeah, so I think for right now, it's a fire hose and the more the merrier. So what it does mean is you can have a lot of experimentation happening for very little amounts of money. And look, I think that's a great thing. It's a great thing for entrepreneurship. It's a great thing for the industry. What's interesting, though, is the funnel does narrow, which is if you look at kind of seed deals, right, we're talking about there's a lot of those. The money's, you know, there's a lot of money there. The number of deals has grown a lot. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the exact numbers are. If something like four or five times over the last, you know, 10 years in terms of kind of if you looked at it from point A to point B.
So there's this vision of VCs as kind of a glamorous lifestyle. You know, when we watch movies like The Social Network, or my favorite show on HBO, Silicon Valley,
yeah.
Which, full disclosure, one of your partners was consulting with them early on.
I'm aware of that.
There's a certain degree of glamour, wealth, riches, and just cutting-edge technology and making decisions that affect how technology develops. I get the sense from your book, it's a little grittier than that. It's a little more hard work and long days and late nights and not all fun and games.
Well, look, I think like any job, it's not all fun and games. And let me be very clear, though, which is nobody should take out their little violins for the venture capitalists. OK, right. I mean, you know, all their kids, you know, have shoes. They all go to school. They all get fed. Right.
They do have shoes. Okay,
right. You know, it is. I certainly even if it's not as glamorous as depicted on TV, we should be very clear.
It's still not bad.
It's still a pretty good place to be.
Right.
I mean, look. The reality is the real heavy lifting gets done on the entrepreneur side, right? So we shouldn't kid ourselves in our business, and we certainly try not to, which is as much as we want to be, you know, kind of finance partners and then hopefully add value in other ways to these companies, the heavy lifting is all being done by the entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm.
I think the part maybe that you're talking about that's, you know, the less glamour part is, look, like any other job, it's competitive, right? And you got to go work hard. It's a question of the real question at the end of the day is, why is an entrepreneur going to pick you versus any of the other firms that they can pick? And that's a big sea change in the business that just didn't exist in the same way in the first 30, 35 years. You know, when the VCs had all the capital, they had a lot more control and a lot more power. And, you know, now we're dealing with, you know, what I think is a very healthy kind of, you know, changing of the guard in some respects. But, you know, VCs don't control boards anymore like they used to, which, again, you know,
you still get a seat on a board if you're going to do an A round and make a substantial investment.
That's right.
I would imagine you want some input into the management and some ability to watch how the money is being spent.
That's exactly right. So, yeah, typically we will have a board seat. And then typically we will have kind of a set of rights that go along with our stock that says, hey, if you're going to raise money, you have to let us vote to say yay or nay. Or if you're going to sell the company, we have some ability to kind of have a say. In the old days, and I was doing air quotes there, you know, the venture capitalists, in addition to that, used to kind of control the board, meaning that there used to be more venture capital board seats on the board than there were founder seats. And, you know, that's in some ways why I think, you know, some of the reputation that the industry had was, hey, some of these guys can get trigger happy sometimes on kicking CEOs out of the business and kicking founders out. That dynamic has really dramatically changed over the last 10 years, and we see more and more boards where the founders kind of control them in the sense that they have more board seats, and it does change the dynamic of the working relationship between them.
So you mentioned that capital used to be scarce, and now it seems pretty plentiful.
It is, yeah.
So I want to explore that and try and figure out how that has impacted markets and startups. What are there now, about 500 unicorns, private companies that are $1 billion valuation? Is that reflecting plentiful capital? Some people have called it a bubble.
Yeah.
I'm not sure that's the right description.
Yeah. We have not, by the way. So, and we've been, you know, on record at this, that I do think if you're talking about this compared to the 99-2000 bubble, it's very different. You know, you and I were talking about this before we started. So, to give you a perspective, right? 99-2000, 700+ IPOs in the tech industry in those 2 years.
Right.
The median revenue, which I didn't realize until I looked this up to confirm it, $17 million, right? So you're talking about companies going public.
With $17 million.
Yeah, with $17 million right. of revenue. Right now, you know, we haven't done 700. We haven't even done 400 IPOs over the last 10 years, in the last decade, right? I mean, we've been doing about 30, maybe 50 a year. So we got a long way to go.
And we look at the revenue at WeWorks or Uber or Airbnb. Yeah. It's pretty
huge. Yeah, the median number, I think, the last I looked for the last 10 years is about 170 million, but that
10x.
Really, yeah, it's 10x, right? But I think that even really understates it, right? I mean, you've got companies, right, like Lyft and Uber and others, right, that are, you know, they're going public with billions of dollars of revenue. So it's a very, very different world. But to your question, though, about kind of, you know, how much capital's out there, it is true there's a lot of capital. And it's kind of a little bit of a tale of two cities, which is you have a lot of capital at the seed stage, right? And we talked about that a little bit. Now, it's not a lot in the total scheme of things in the sense that it's about 6% of capital total in the venture capital world is seed. So it's grown a lot over the years, but it's not, you know, we're not talking 20, 30% of the capital.
Right.
And then you have kind of the A and the B rounds have kind of not moved that much. They've moved a little bit, but there's a little bit more capital. And then you have this big influx of capital in the kind of call it the C plus rounds,
like
the later
late
rounds.
Stage pre IPO rounds
that's
that
exactly
maybe
right.
20 years ago would have been public instead of a private.
That's
round.
Exactly right. So the best way to see this is it used to be the case that from founding of a company to IPO, it was about six and a half years is typically what it used to be. Today, that's about 10 to 12 years. So you've pretty much basically doubled in the last decade the time it's taking for companies to go public. And you're exactly right. So what's happening is you got all this capital that used to be in the public markets that's now saying, hey, we want some of that growth, right? We want these growth companies because we're not getting them in the public markets. And that capital now is coming into the private markets. And that's what's driving these very, very large rounds you see in the private markets.
So here's another interesting stat from the book I thought was fascinating. 15 of the biggest 25 IPOs in 2018 were from companies that had no profits. So how should we be thinking about young companies that basically, you know, are losing a little money? The joke is Uber loses a little money on each ride, but they make it up in volume.
Right, exactly.
So how do we think about these companies that are growing rapidly and have nice revenue, but are far away from profitability?
So I think the way you have to think about it, and look, the way you if you're getting comfortable investing in them, the way you have to think about it is you have to look at kind of what we call the unit economics, right? So in other words, show me kind of at a unit level, so at a geographic market level or at kind of a per ride level, does the business work and are we losing money in aggregate because we are now focused on growth in other markets? And when those markets are at a level of maturity, you know, you will see profitability. So, you know, we're a shareholder in Lyft, right? And so
competitor for Uber.
A competitor of Uber, right. So, and if you looked at Lyft, right, you know, my impression is when they went out on the road, what they probably did is they said, hey, look at our mature markets. Look at a San Francisco or look at, you know, Boston or whatever that might be. These are markets that are mature, and we can demonstrably show you kind of the profits that we actually make in those mature markets. And oh, by the way, we've got a bunch of these immature markets, but if you believe the story, right, then those immature markets over time will get to the same levels of profitability,
right.
And then therefore the companies themselves are profitable. I think that's the way to think about it, and that's what the investors are trying to do. You know, it'll be incumbent, obviously, upon these companies to actually prove that and demonstrate that, you know, kind of the story actually matches reality.
Here's the question. So we have these big, fast-growing, well-funded companies that aren't profitable. What happens in the next down cycle?
Yeah. Well, look, I think that's a real question. And I think this is why actually you see in the IPO market right now that the IPOs of companies are trading differently, I think, based upon kind of whether they are profitable and or how much cash ultimately they are consuming. So if you look at kind of the companies that have performed the best, they tend to be enterprise software companies like a Zoom, for example, or, you know, we saw CrowdStrike.
Lots of scale, lots of leverage.
Right. So they've got, you know, they're growing fast. They're also profitable businesses. And so, look, in a downturn, you could say, look, maybe they don't grow as fast, but they're not. There's not an existential threat to that business, right? So people are going to, if you're a CrowdStrike investor, look, people are going to buy security software at some point in time, even in a downturn. And so if it slows a little bit or if they lose a little bit of money, that's okay, not a big deal. And then, you know, you do see like the Ubers of the world where people say, hey, look, you know, you're telling us profitability in 2023, which means, you know, you may be reliant on the capital markets to raise more capital over that time period. And I think that's why you tend to see more volatility in those kinds of stocks that have this big cash consumption.
So I keep coming back to the issue of how much capital is sloshing around.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about the Vision Fund.
Yep.
What's the Vision Fund And how is this impacting the landscape out there?
Yeah, so the Vision Fund is a fund that was raised by SoftBank, which is obviously a big Japanese conglomerate.
And it's huge.
It's huge. It's $100 billion, right? And it's as far as I know, at least, it's certainly the biggest fund that I've heard of that's, you know, effectively a fund structure investing in, you know, private equity and venture-backed companies.
Now, I know you probably don't want to bash a competitor in your space, but I imagine that much money in the hands of humans, and they're just doling it out willy-nilly and overpaying for stuff and saying, hey, I got $100 billion to deploy. Go out and find some more companies. I'm exaggerating a little bit, but is there any truth to that?
Well, it's interesting. So a couple of years ago, SoftBank was kind of a class of one, right? They were the 800-pound gorilla, right?
Right.
There was nobody else of that scale. And look, they had you know, look, people do what their incentives are, right? Which is, so if you
sure.
worked at the SoftBank Vision Fund, clearly your incentive was to go invest money. Now, whether they were overpaying or doling it out, look, I mean, time will tell, obviously. And, you know, they do have a different kind of cost of capital, right? In other words, they're not trying to necessarily get a 3X or a 5X return on a company. They have a lower kind of return hurdle. So in theory, they could afford to pay more than maybe somebody like us could pay for the same business,
right?
Because we have to deliver a higher rate of return.
You have to be more efficient. They have the luxury of not caring about that
ROI. It's not that we have to be more efficient. It's that we are, our investors say, look, for you to stay in business, we want to see 3 times our money being returned in every fund cycle, basically.
Over 7 years.
10 years, right,
ten
is what
years.
They are. Yeah.
Okay.
So give us 3 times your money, you know, which probably means somewhere between 25 and 30%, you know, kind of IRRs, right, annualized returns.
Mm-hmm. And not if you, too shabby.
Yeah, if you do that, look, we'll keep giving you the money. You get to play the game again.
I mentioned earlier, you are my third victim from Andreessen Horowitz. not only did I have a nice time talking to Benedict Evans, who has a wonderful newsletter that comes out of your shop, as well as, is it one or two podcasts?
I think it's probably two at this point in time, yeah.
but I had a great time speaking with Mark Andreessen in the Pitch conference room.
That's awesome.
Which was fun. And if you listen to that interview, you could hear me bang the table.
All right, I'm going to go back.
And
see
it's
if I can
pretty
find
hilarious because it was just one of those like surreal locations to do a podcast. And I had a number of people email me and say, you know, I normally listen at 2 times regular speed.
Right.
But this guy talks so fast, I couldn't keep up with it. I'm like,
that's funny.
Have you not heard Mark Andreessen speak before? He's like a New Yorker. He's like,
he is a fast speaker.
And a lot of interesting, dense stuff. So I take that as a compliment when someone says, I had to listen at regular at regular speed.
Didn't want to miss a word. That's good.
We mentioned earlier you were employee number one
after
Andreessen and Horowitz. What is your role today? You're managing partner.
Yeah.
What does that mean? What's your day job like?
So it's a lot of things. Actually, my nickname inside the firm is actually called Slash, like kind of the
cut the
slash,
costs.
Right. Well, no, actually not Slash, like cut costs. Slash as in I have a lot of jobs, right?
So, oh, I gotcha.
So some days it's
like,
you know,
hyphen, Mr. Hyphen.
Hyphen, exactly, yeah. Right. So some days it's go raise money. So we just, you know, finished a fundraise not too long ago. So
how
I
much
spent,
did you guys raise?
We just raised about $3 billion, actually.
I've been quoting
funds.
$7 billion.
I know seven, actually, believe it or not, is out of date as of, you know, literally about 30 days ago.
Wow.
So I apologize for
not at all. It's in the book and it's in your,
I know, yeah. We
fix Wikipedia. It's
exactly.
Wrong. Right? Go figure. Who would have ever guessed something on Wikipedia was wrong?
I know.
So closer to $10 billion?
We're just about over 10 now.
That's fantastic.
So it's great. Yeah. No, it's been a lot of fun. So what most of my job?
But by the way,
day,
how many people get to say, yeah, I raised $3 billion. It's been a lot of fun. You must really love your job.
I do love my job. It's great. I mean, I love the capital raising part of it. We have a great limited partner base, and so it's a lot of fun to do that.
And a lot of pensions and endowments.
We do,
universities.
Pensions, endowments, universities. We do have some sovereign wealth funds, too, so we talked about those kind of in one of our segments. Some family offices, not that many. And then we're starting to build up more of an international base now. So kind of most of it was North America, really basically U.S.
Right.
And we're thinking now we've kind of expanded into Europe and then, you know, some parts of the Middle East and some parts of Asia. So it's been a fun opportunity just to kind of learn that side of the business.
Can a VC scale significantly above where you are? I mean, if you were a software company, we didn't talk about how software, I hear, is eating the world.
Yes.
But if you were, if you're a software company, you could scale up infinitely.
Yeah.
You know, Google Docs, nothing's going to prevent every person in the world from having 100 sheets and docs on Google Docs. It just scales infinitely. You literally have partners who have to sign off on stuff, associates who have to do some of the grunt work. There's a lot of decisions to be made. Yep. Where do you top out?
Yeah, this is the real conundrum with this business is, so the limiter in scale is basically the number of board seats that a general partner can sit on, right? And it varies, you know, some people top out at 10. We've got some of our folks who are doing like 15 and 16 who think they can go do 25. You know,
we'll see
if they get there, but you're right. So the kind of limiters are, at some point in time, you tap out your board seats, and then at some point in time, the room gets so big where you just have too many people, you know, trying to express an opinion. So the way we're trying to solve that is we do a little bit more kind of verticalization, basically. So I mentioned earlier that
you can create different sleeves and
different
areas of expertise.
That's right, yeah. So we've got a consumer team, right? And so we can grow that team more because, you know, right now there are probably, what, 4 people on our consumer team. And so you could probably continue to grow that as long as the deal opportunity set is there and you don't have too many people in the room to make a decision, right? Our financial services team is too strong today. You could certainly grow that more. So we're trying to say, look, let's push the decision-making down at the vertical level to the teams that have the right domain expertise. And then above a certain dollar threshold, hey, if someone wants to write a $50 million or $100 million check, let's kind of get everybody in the room and make sure that nobody's going to blow a hole in the, you know, in the side of the ship, right?
Right. So 170 employees, how many partners out of that group?
So we have 15 partners today.
All right. 90-10 relationship, like a law firm or similar, right?
Yeah.
Some of the big firms, it was 7-to-1 sort of ratio.
The other big difference, though, with our firm, right, is 100 of those 170 people actually work with our companies post-investment. So we're kind of an odd beast in the venture capital
meaning
world.
That they're not going to your office each day. They're going to the entrepreneur's
startup. No. So they're at our office. They work for us, but they do things like, hey, can we help you get introduced to Bloomberg, to the CIO or the CTO of Bloomberg?
So more of what I would traditionally imagine is a partner's job description. You're pushing that down to mid-level staff.
That's exactly right. So the whole idea behind the firm was kind of this concept of, look, can we disaggregate the general partner job and say, what are the things that we really need the general partner to do, right?
I love these buzzwords. It's so good. You're going to disaggregate the partners.
Disaggregate, right. How about that?
You know what? That's an accurate description.
Yeah. So, you know, we want a general partner to look for great deals, build relationships, make investment decisions, and sit on boards and be valuable to those companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
But we don't necessarily need a general partner who's not an expert in recruiting CFOs to know how to do that. So instead, we have a whole talent team. And that's their job, is let's know all the top CFOs in the business, let's build relationships with them, and then where appropriate, let's connect them into our portfolio companies, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so we do that on talent, on both executives as well as engineers. We do that on sales and business development prospects. So, you know, we cover companies like Bloomberg and others and say, who are the decision makers
mm-hmm.
that might buy software here or that might, you know, buy ad time for some of our ad-based companies? And we ought to know all those people and then figure out when can we connect them into our companies to help them accelerate their sales.
Really intriguing. What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done. So what are your vertical specialties? What are the different groups?
Yeah, so right now there's a couple. So basically kind of consumer is one, and think of that as, you know, that's a Facebook, an Instacart.
Anything that the end user,
essentially where the end
we
user
used to call
consumer,
that B2C
yes,
back in the
yes,
day.
Yes, exactly right.
I'm old, so.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's a good way to think about it. Financial services, so fintech is one,
right.
And that kind of has some B2C and some B2B elements of it, right? So it could be, we have a company called Affirm, which basically is kind of point of sale lending. I don't know if you know this, but so if you buy a Casper mattress, you know, and when you're
they do the financing, right?
So that's an interesting
company.
Have
the ability to make a fairly instantaneous
extension of credit. That's exactly right.
Above and beyond a credit card or somewhere between a credit card and a bank loan is where they sit.
That's exactly right. Mm-hmm. And then on, you know, completely other end of the spectrum, we've got a company called Branch, which basically does lending to sub-Saharan African countries, basically, and people in those countries. So literally think of it as a taxi driver or a local store owner.
Micro-lending, right?
So who doesn't have credit, right? Basically, in a lot of these countries, you know, we have these credit bureaus, right? So you have kind of, you get your credit score, and then you take that to the lender. In a lot of these other countries, there is no concept of a credit bureau. So a company like Branch literally is building people's individual credit files by giving them small micro-loans, and then as they pay it back, obviously they start
to get a higher track record.
A higher credit limit. So that's fintech. Enterprise. So enterprise could be anything from like an application company, like a Slack, for example, would be in that, to something more esoteric like a security company or a company that's doing, you know, a database or things of that sort. We do crypto, which is an interesting area, which we can talk about.
Sure. Let's talk a little bit about crypto.
Good.
So this crazy Facebook Libra thing.
I walked right into that one.
Let's just talk about this. So Facebook, who has helped undermine democracy as they as they worked hand-in-hand with the Russians to spread fake news, decided that they want to replace money. So how could that ever go wrong?
Yeah. So they're not, they don't want to replace money. They want to create internet money.
Okay? Right.
Right. So that's the way to think about it. That's at least how we think
internet
about it.
Internet money. Not ACH, not credit, Venmo.
That's right.
Which... I use Venmo as a verb inappropriately, the young guys in my office tell me.
Oh, really?
So when I owed someone money, they bought tickets for something, I said, just Venmo me. And he's like, dude, that's just, and I'm like, just Venmo.
I think that's pretty forward.
So he said, Venmo. He goes, I'm going to invoice you. You're going to Venmo me. Do I really? Okay. I'll be more formal. So send me your request, and I will pay you. Is that better?
Yeah.
But anyway, that's a really interesting technology.
So the concept, right? So the concept is, again, we've been using this term internet money, right? So if you think about it, there are things like, of course, there are things like PayPal and stuff like that today, but they all depend on, you're right, they depend on ACH.
Either banks or credit cards
or
something.
Stuff like that.
Right.
And it's expensive. Not everybody has access to that. And particularly in countries like, you know, Venezuela, for example, right, where, you know, you've got these hyperinflation countries, people want, you know, a stable currency that they actually don't have to worry about, you know, putting in wheelbarrows every day. And so what basically the Facebook consortium that they put together is, you know, intending to do is to say, look, could we create this concept of internet money so that you can procure things on the internet? You can even do like micropayments, which is very hard to do because of transaction costs. So, you know, if you wanted to charge people 10 cents an episode to listen to your podcast, maybe that's a good way to monetize the podcast instead of advertising, for example.
10 cents.
You know.
I'm doing the math.
I don't know if that's the right math.
I'm
maybe
in.
We need to charge
where do we sign up for this? All right. You've converted me to Libra.
Right. But you couldn't do that today, right? Because, you know, by the time you took transaction fees and stuff, you would be losing. You'd be basically paying the credit card company to charge somebody 10 cents. So that's the kind of big idea of what they're trying to do. Now, look, it's, you know, it's brand new. It's a consortium. It's going to be developed in a crypto framework, which means it will be decentralized and governed by all these different kind of groups that are being part of it. So it's not going to be Facebook actually centralizing it and owning it. And, you know, it'll be an interesting experiment to see if they can make it work.
So let me ask you a disclosure question. So you guys famously were an early investor in Facebook. It worked out fabulously for that investment. Are you still a Facebook holder, or has that long since been worked out?
So as a fund, we don't hold Facebook shares anymore. A lot of us individually do, and I will personally disclose. I do hold Facebook shares, and I don't know if Mark or other people still do. I assume Mark does because he's on the board, so probably I imagine he gets, you know, some kind of grant of
stock. Sure, every quarter or every year.
But in general, kind of the way our business works is, you know, our LPs pay us to manage private assets, right?
Right.
And so
once it's public,
look, they have a manager. They can go hire you if they want to buy Facebook
stock. So here's a question.
Do
you sell their Facebook shares, or do you dole that out to the LPs and let them sell it?
Usually what we do is we distribute the shares to the LPs.
That's really interesting.
Yeah. And then, you know, different LPs do different things. Some of them actually say, look, every time I get a distribution from a venture capitalist, I'm just going to automatically sell it. I'm not going to make an independent judgment.
Right.
Some of them, particularly the ones who are more sophisticated, say, wait a second, you know, I like Facebook stock, and oh, by the way, one of my public managers has it, but I want an overweight position in Facebook stock, so you know what? I'm just going to hold on to this.
And this has such a low cost basis.
That's
I can
exactly
hold on
right.
to
yeah.
it for this. Although they're really, I'm going to say most of them are pretty profits, right.
Yeah, so most taxes of them don't care aren't about an issue for right? them. They have the luxury of not having
I
to worry
immediately
about that.
Think of cost basis.
Trust me, you and I are thinking the same thing.
It makes a big difference, yeah. You know? And then there's where you're going to locate the assets. You're going to put in these guys,
exactly,
they're
right,
all
yeah.
completely tax exempt.
These guys are all
so
tax exempt, right? Yeah.
It shouldn't make any
difference.
But
that's basically how we think about the business. So look, in general, yeah, like if they want to buy Facebook stock, they can buy Facebook stock. They don't need to pay us to do that.
That makes perfect sense. I didn't ask you during our broadcast portion the venture capital life cycle,
yes,
which you talk about in the book.
Yeah.
Let's get a little wonky and talk about life cycles, and then I want to talk about persistency and underfitting.
Awesome. Yeah.
So we're really going to wonk out.
Wow.
So what's the VC life cycle?
Yeah. So basically, we raise funds, and those funds typically have a 10-year life. Now, if you talk to any LP,
but 10 years. I'm going to interrupt you.
Yes.
Is 10 years standard? I kind of remember it being a little shorter years ago, 7-8 years.
I don't
or
know
is
if
this
that's changed.
10
to be
years
honest.
Pretty con-
since
common.
I've been in the business, it's been 10.
I'll defer to you.
It's actually, and the opposite is actually true, which is, but any LP will tell you there's no such thing as a 10-year fund. These funds go 12, 13, 14, 15 years.
Because you're always left with stubs that haven't done anything.
Yeah. And hopefully,
but
they have
the
some value.
Bulk of it, the assumption is, hey, if it's not done by 10 years, just write it down to zero, and
right,
whatever comes out later
that's
is
exactly
a bonus.
Right. Yeah, that's
so,
exactly right.
And I don't know if stub is the right technical term.
I think it is a technical term, stub, yeah.
But I'm under the impression that after a certain point, it either works or it doesn't, and
yeah,
it's not going to catch fire in the 11th year. So all right, we just needed
maybe
to go one more year.
But
and
remember,
then,
right, it's taking 10, 11, 12 years for companies to go public now, so it's possible that it could catch fire. So it depends on whether
yeah,
it's
I
on
guess.
That path or not.
I guess, and at that point, it's certainly easy enough to find somebody who's going to
that's exactly right,
come
yeah
in and take it off your hands.
Yeah. So anyways, you got 10 years, basically. You do most of your investing typically in the first 3 or 4 years is what's mm-hmm more typical. And then kind of in those later years, you're doing what's called follow-on investing, right? You're kind of maybe adding to positions that you've
had. A second round.
Doing second round or third round or stuff like that.
How does the
yeah
capital calls work? Is it like a hedge fund where all the money shows up? Or is it like private equity where you make a commitment?
Yep.
Give a small amount of money up front, and then they call it as needed.
Yeah, it's the latter. So basically, when an LP invests in our fund, what they're doing is they're saying, okay, like I'm committing to $10 million over the life of your fund, and you know we'll call it kind of, we typically call quarterly because you know we kind of generally know what the cadence is.
Right.
So yeah, think about it as probably 70% of your money gets called in that first 3 or 4 years when you're
mm-hmm
doing primary investing, and then the remainder gets called over years 4 through 8 or 9 or something, you know, for that follow-on investing.
Hmm, that's pretty interesting. And so that's the life cycle over of a typical fund.
That's right. And then, you know, we'll go raise a new fund, hopefully. So hopefully after 3 or 4 years, if we've, you know, exhausted that fund, if we're doing well enough, then our LPs will say, great, like, we'll give you another shot at it and you go raise a new fund.
And each new fund is a new legal entity.
That's correct.
With I want to call it A16Z.
You can call it A16Z.
But people are not going to understand what that is. So I have this great blue hat that sits in my car. And it literally says A16Z.com.
Hey, I like
and
that.
And there are 16 letters between the A in Andreessen and the Z
wow
in
you got it. You got it.
I mean, it wasn't, hey, I cracked that code. It wasn't too difficult. But it's really a very interesting idea, and it allows you guys to come up with a almost random web URL. You
absolutely
go to get a website.
I know.
They're
imagine
all taken.
Yeah.
It's kind of crazy.
And it
so
allows people to actually find it, because if you had to spell AndreessenHorowitz.com
right,
every time, we'd be out of business.
S's,
we'd be
I
out
always
of business
get
in 2 years.
That,
yeah, exactly.
I always get that wrong. So
persistence was what you mentioned. We didn't talk about it. Do you want
to
talk about
it? Sure.
No?
Let's talk about so each of these are separate
yeah
fund. You're the firm is the GP, and it may or may not be the same LPs in
yeah
it.
That's right.
And so you just did Fund 6.
That's right.
If you're just raising money for Fund 6 and that was put to bed, Fund 7 is a couple of years down
that's
the road.
That's probably right. Yeah, we tell our LPs kind of think about it as 2.5, 3, 3.5 year cycles is probably the right way to think about it.
So let's talk about persistence, which is kind right of interesting. And again, I, at risk of I don't want to put words in your mouth and slag a competitor.
No.
But
no,
let
no
me just talk about some of the talk of the town. So Kleiner Perkins, one of the most storied, John Doerr and that whole collection of folks, incredible Cisco
yeah
and Apple
right
and Microsoft. I mean, go down the list. It was insane.
Yeah.
Intel. They did fabulously in the 80s and the 90s. The latter funds seem to have not had the same track record. So the question is, was it luck? Or did the environment change so much that they failed to adapt? Did that whole sex discrimination case throw them off their game? These are my words, not yours. I don't want to put...
I was going to say that, right?
You have to see these
people, I'm listening to everything you're saying.
Want anybody saying, hey, Scott, what the hell, man?
Yeah.
So this is... I apologize to John Doerr and everybody. I'm repeating what I read.
Yeah.
I don't know this for a fact. I've never met these folks. You certainly have never sent any of this, so
right.
I'm giving you...
Good, I appreciate
I'm
it.
I'm giving you some plausible deniability.
Yeah.
Kleiner,
so look, first of all, you're upset with Kleiner is, you know, an icon in the industry. There's no question, right?
And their early track record was just eye-popping.
Yeah, and then,
right?
You know, they also had a whole life sciences part of their business.
Sure.
You know, people like Brooke Byers, right? One of the name partners there have done great things. And actually right now they have a whole new set of, a whole new team. So they've kind of brought on some new people to kind of build out their software business. And,
mm-hmm.
and look, they've successfully raised new funds and stuff. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't count anybody out of this business. I mean, they're an iconic name with an iconic brand.
But that brings us back to the issue of persistency.
Yeah, the persistence issue, yeah. So
the whole concept of fat head, long tail is there's a handful of winners.
Yep.
It's a winner-take-all distribution. And those winners tend to stay winners.
Yeah.
So explain.
Yeah, it's really interesting, right? So if you look at all the academic literature around VC, basically, you have a firm that performs in the top quartile of returns in one cycle is likely to then continue to be in the top quartile in the next cycle, right?
Mm-hmm.
In their next fund. And I think the theory behind it goes back to a little bit of this kind of idea that we talked about earlier about kind of zero sum and signaling, which is, you know, if you're a firm like Kleiner Perkins, let's just use them as an example. You have a brand and you've invested in some of these fantastic companies like Cisco and Apple. And so, you know, I'm an entrepreneur who is, you know, looking to kind of get that brand affiliation to help me with my business, right? So I want your money because, you know, you've invested in smart people before and therefore you must think I'm smart.
Their money is more than just money.
That's right, right? It goes with the brand and with the success they built over time, right? And so if I'm trying to recruit employees, you know, I say, hey, well, you know, I've got money from these Kleiner Perkins folks in this case. You know, they're smart, therefore, you know, you should come work for me, right? Do something
mm-hmm.
crazy like quit your job and tell your spouse that you're going to take a 50% cut in pay and come work for me. Or if you're a customer, you know, you have kind of the customer kind of gets the brand connotation of Kleiner Perkins. They may not know you, but they've heard of John Doerr. They've heard of, you know, that organization. So
mm-hmm.
you get that kind of brand affiliation. So I think that's why there is this persistence.
Mm-hmm.
And then therefore, also, as we talked about, because these deals are often zero sum, if you've got the brand, that gives you an unfair advantage in competing for the new deals. And when you win that A round of the deal, that means nobody else in the industry got to win that deal either, right? So you kind of allow that persistence to kind of, you know, take effect and give you competitive advantage.
Now, this is the same thing we see in, where do you want to go with this? Hedge funds.
Exactly right. Yeah.
Ivy League schools.
Yeah.
Is Harvard really Harvard, or
absolutely.
Are they just coasting on their reputation
yeah,
for
no, look, you're right.
400 years?
Yeah, look, we use signaling all the time, right? And you're right. It's not necessarily fair. Look, there's plenty of smart students at other places that don't go to Stanford or Harvard, but, you know, an employer looks at that and they say, hey, like, you know, it's probably the case that they've screened the student, they've done
right.
something, and so, you know, I accept that as kind of, you know, brand affiliation for that student. But you're absolutely right. It's not fair, but it is unfortunately, you know, part of the way the world works.
So we're not talking about fair. We're talking about if you're a pension fund or if you're an allocator and you have to decide, hey, I'm going to budget 5% of my assets to venture capital.
Yeah.
In the world of hedge funds, if you're not in that top 10%, you're paying a lot for not great performance. It sounds like the VC world is very, very similar. If you're not in the top firms, well, then you're really, as you pointed out, on aggregate, going to
yeah.
underperform the public market.
Yeah, this is where I think a lot of the LPs sometimes have kind of made mistakes in their venture portfolio is, you know, they...
Diversify.
Yeah, they diversify, right? Diversification turns out to be a bad strategy in venture, right? Which
right.
is, look, if you've got, you know, if you are with a great firm who's in the top quartile, you know, obviously things change, and of course, maybe all the partners leave or, you know, something catastrophic happens, but in general... You want to probably double down your money on those folks as opposed to actually, you know, kind of diversifying.
So places. The names I know, like Flatiron Ventures or Benchmark,
sure.
in addition to Kleiner Perkins Andreessen, and I know there are dozens and dozens
yeah.
of others, the well-known top-tier firms really are well-known and top-tier for a reason.
That's right, yeah. And look, those are great firms. And so what happens, right, is the LPs want to allocate to those firms. And then what often happens, I think, where sometimes the LPs make mistakes is they say, look, I can't get access because, you know, I'll pick on
funds,
Benchmark, right?
Funds
yeah,
closed.
Benchmark, right. Benchmark's, you know, you know, it's very hard to be a new LP and get access to a benchmark fund. They're so good that, right, they haven't really added to their LP base. And so then people sometimes say, okay, well, let me go down to the next tier or the next tier. And then unfortunately, and a lot of times in this business, you know, that means that you now start to get those returns we talked about, right, which converge to the median as opposed to the top returns.
Mean reversion is a,
exactly right, yes.
Is quite a mean mistress.
It's alive and well, yes.
A cruel mistress. So I made a reference, but we really didn't get into Andreessen's piece, Software is Eating the World.
Yeah.
That was 2011, and that turned out to be a fabulous call.
Yeah.
So really the question is software still eating the world? And when does this, you know, get replaced by whatever is going to replace software? Or does that just never end? It just keeps going.
Yeah. I think software is still eating the world, at least where we sit. We think it will continue to eat the world for, I don't know what the time period is, but I don't know.
Until
I don't,
Fun 47.
Exactly right. I don't see an end to it at this point, mm-hmm, in time. And actually what's interesting now is, it's starting to touch a lot of industries that historically it never got to. So now we're starting to see software eating a little bit of education, a little bit of healthcare, government services, oil and gas markets, energy markets. So there's these, you know, very, very big markets that for a long time kind of were, you know, largely untouched. And I think we're still at the very, very beginning phases of it. So it's been our investment thesis for a long time. I think it's going to be our investment thesis for the foreseeable future.
So I'm going to throw a curveball at you. Uh-oh. Only because you brought it up. So healthcare... Healthcare is such a fascinating,
yeah,
area. You guys have looked at biological sciences,
yeah,
not really where you really focus.
We do actually have a bio fund.
Right,
yeah,
but the whole, there's a huge amount of genomics and, yeah, go down the whole list of stuff. Yeah. You're really more hardcore tech, not life sciences, but you,
yeah,
do, as you said, you do have. But when you brought it up, I immediately thought of the Berkshire Hathaway, Amazon, J.P. Morgan,
right,
Chase,
right, the
concept,
right,
of,
yeah,
hey, healthcare in the United States is broken and we want to explore fixing it. When you see something like that, does your VC Pavlovian response start to go off and say, yes, it's broken and technology can fix it and here's $1 billion? Like, how do you,
yeah,
hear, like when I heard that story, I'm like, damn, that's some serious firepower there.
Yeah, yeah.
How is this perceived at a shop where you're looking for the next great disruptive technology?
Yeah, yeah. Look, we all take notice when things like that happen, obviously, particularly with those companies, because they're obviously all iconic companies and have tremendous resources. In general, though, funding something like that is not really, that's just not really our MO, right? So, mm-hmm, our, you know, we may like that idea and we say, great. Now, is there a set of, you know, entrepreneurs who are starting from scratch with a completely blank slate and we can, you know, invest $2, $3, $5 million in them,
right,
to go try to build something that could be, you know, equivalent in terms of the results that those three companies might deliver, but can do it where it's a tech first company and is really driven kind of bottoms up from the tech side. So it certainly kind of, you know, piques our interest, but it's not, it's just not in the scope of what we tend to do from a funding perspective.
And really the last, I have a couple more questions, but
sure,
I don't want to torture you with this. One is debt versus equity, and the other is valuations. You,
sure,
write about debt versus equity is a question that all entrepreneurs should think about.
Yeah.
Explain why that's significant,
yeah,
and how they should contextualize
it. Yeah,
that.
So I think there's a couple issues to think about on debt versus equity. So one is, and let's assume we're talking about real debt here, not convertible debt, right? So debt, mm-hmm, that actually is going to stay there. The problem with debt is at some point you have to pay it back. Right. And, you know, it's not that we want to be frivolous with equity.
You have to pay.
But, you know, so if you think about it from a startup perspective, right, for you to take debt and then say, OK, 3 years from now, when hopefully my business is finally starting to hum, now I got to take money out of, you know, that I could be plowing into R&D or other stuff.
Right.
And I got to go pay it back. Like it's what we call, it's not permanent capital. Right. So it can serve a purpose. But, you know, I think for a startup business, it's a dangerous kind of, you know, path to get on because you want the permanency of capital that allows you to kind of make the investments into the company that you hopefully want to invest in. So, you know, a lot of our companies do what's called convertible debt sometimes where, you know, kind of that debt will start off as debt, but then it turns into equity at some point in time. And, you know, people...
Why do that as opposed to straight equity?
Look, personally, you know, from our perspective, and we've been public on this, we would rather people do straight equity. Convertible debt started largely, I think, because people said it's cheaper, it's just faster, you don't have to have, you know, hours and hours of lawyers doing this stuff. And it kind of punts the valuation question, right? We don't have to decide on the valuation today. We say, hey, look, in the future, when there's equity round, we'll just convert it at that price or some discount, but we don't need to go fight about valuation.
Huh.
It's grown a lot. It's problematic for a lot of reasons. I think the most place we see problems is founders will kind of do many debt rounds, and then they don't really realize until they finally go to raise an equity round, when all that debt converts into equity, they realize, oh my gosh, I've sold a lot more of the company than I realized, right? Because you don't have that tangible, hey, you know, I got $5 million and I gave up 25% of my company or something like that.
The math is easy to track when it's pure equity.
Harder, yeah.
And then the last question I have to ask you about is valuation.
Yes.
And I still have in my head Mark's comment that, hey, look at all the companies that blew up in 2000, 2001, 2002. They've all since, the ideas were fine. They were just a little ahead of themselves.
Yeah, yeah.
The perfect example, back then it was Pets.com.
Chewy.com.
And now Chewy is just...
Webvan and Instacart.
Yep.
Right? Mirror images of one another, basically.
So... And his take was, for when we're looking for 50 or 100 baggers, stop and think about it. If the example he used is, I think he was in Facebook at like a $20 million valuation. What happens if I paid $100 million? Does it make any difference when it's 50 billion or 100 billion?
All right, so this
it's almost irrelevant at that point. And for a public equity guy, I'm aghast at that. But intellectually, His math makes sense.
Yeah. So it's funny. I'll give you a little bit inside baseball. So this is the number one thing that Mark and I fight about all the time inside the firm.
Really?
Yeah. So I think his principle is right. And I've told him this before, so hopefully he won't fire me when he hears this. His principle is
bad
right.
Bad news, Scott.
His principle is absolutely right, which is, look, you're right. If you're going to invest in Facebook, look, the difference between a $30 million or a $40 million or $50 million valuation, who cares, right? It's $100 billion. It went to $500 billion. We can all
look at that. Look at it in aggregate against maybe the companies that weren't.
I think that's right. I think the problem is it's very hard then to know what is the price at which you wouldn't actually make that investment. In other words, so if I would make it at 50 or 100, would you pay 500 for Facebook at that point in time? And look, in retrospect, it was Facebook, so again, you wouldn't pay anything. But
back out the hindsight bias, a company that we don't know, XYZ, we don't know what it's going to be.
Right.
Where do you draw a line?
Yeah, so what we try to do, right, is we try to say, okay, let's assume everything works out, okay? So what could this company be at scale, right? So how big can it get? What's the market size, right? All those things. Mm-hmm. And then we say, okay, look, if you believe that it can actually get to a $10, $20 billion company, and you're right, you're trying to optimize for 10, 25, 50 times your money, there's at least a range of prices, and it's you're right. If you loved it at $30 million, you probably are still loving it at $40 million. But maybe the answer is, look, you don't love it at $100 million.
Right.
The other piece to think about is it's not just the entry valuation that matters for that purpose.
It's the next round.
It's the next
round.
That's exactly right. That's what I'd say, which is, at some point in time—
Got to leave yourself a little upside.
That's exactly right. And so that's the other risk, I think, that you can get into if you don't at least think critically about valuation is you may be happy, but then, look, these guys are going to go raise, another two, three, four rounds, and if every round, every investor feels like they're getting pushed, it doesn't work. Now, there are examples where that works, we famously, didn't invest in Square, which
worked out.
Turned out to be great. Right. And at every round, it always felt like you were paying ahead of what the actual intrinsic value of the business was. But the reality is that's the way a lot of these things look. So I think his principle is right. But I think you just have to say, okay, look, there is some limit at which we say, okay, the risk of next round financing and kind of the real upside opportunity is somewhat constrained by valuation.
So let's take an example: Uber, giant, by any measure, successful startup company.
Yeah.
I think if you were a private investor, 80% of the private investors are underwater based on where the
based
most
on where
recent
it's
price
trading
is.
Today, right? Yeah. That may be right, but there are also people like Benchmark and lots of other firms who are certainly not underwater.
Sure.
Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah, look, I mean, I would say, I guess, a couple things about Uber. We're Lyft investors, so, you can take this with a big grain of salt.
I disagree with my friend Scott Galloway and Andrew Stern, who thinks Lyft is toast. There's only going to be one winner here. Hey, what name a field where there isn't a Pepsi to the Coke?
Yeah, I think
that's
right.
What this
is. I don't think that's the case. I mean, obviously, look, we bet that way and we believe that. The only other thing I'd say about Uber, and I'd say it's about Lyft too, which is, look, yes, they're underwater today. Judging these companies, though, I think based on 3, 4, or 5 weeks of stock price trading is a little bit unfair.
That's
totally
unfair.
Look, Facebook, right? Facebook, went to $14 a
share. They had
a
crappy IPO before it all turns around.
And so, look, at some point in time, yes, these companies will all trade on some multiple of cash flow at some point in time, and then we'll really be able to judge, quite frankly, whether they're overvalued or not.
And my last question before I get to my favorite speed round questions. WeWork seems to be just off the charts, where a floor in a WeWorks building is worth more than the building itself.
Yeah.
Does any of this make any sense?
Yeah, so we're not investors in WeWork.
Right. So you can tell us the straight
down. Well, look, and I don't know the numbers, but I do think there is this big question, which is fundamentally, is it a technology company or is it a very successful real estate business, right? And look, if it's the latter, we know that those things will trade on some cap rate at some point in time.
Right.
And
it's all about IRR relative to the cost of
real
estate.
The question. Look, and I don't know, since I'm not an investor, look, maybe they have some story, which is, look, maybe there's technology or something else, which means they should trade at a premium to a REIT, basically, because of, you know, better margins or something like that. I don't know. But I think, look, that is the fundamental question for them. And I think that's what, you know, if they go public, as at least it's rumored that they might go soon, I think, you know, we'll have the public market's ability to weigh in on that pretty soon.
So I only have you here for a finite time, they're telling me. So let's jump to our favorite questions that I ask all my guests. Feel free to go as long or short with these as you like.
Right. Yeah.
Your first car, make, year, and model.
My first car was actually a Peugeot 505 STI.
Wow.
It was an old one. And actually, I'll tell you, though, I loved it for the time it wasn't in the shop, basically.
Right.
It was literally, you know, in the shop every other day. But, boy, when it wasn't, it was a fun car to drive.
To say the least, that is a fun car. What's the most important thing that people don't know about Scott Cooper?
Well, I tell a little bit about it in the book, but I am. Well, maybe the most important thing is, look, I'm the most introverted person probably you will ever meet, which I know sounds funny.
No, I can relate to that.
You're vastly
overcompensating.
Right. I play an extrovert on TV, but
you are not the only person who.
What I like to do is I like to go home and read a book and sit on my couch and watch Netflix. And
what could be better? Than I agree. That, right. I am right there with you. Who were some of your early mentors?
I was actually mentored by a family friend, a guy named Armin Weinberg is his name. I grew up in Houston. And he ran the MD Anderson Hospital, which is a very famous kind of, you know, cancer hospital. He ran a bunch of studies around, you know, kind of early cancer prevention. And so we did some research on, you know, how do you detect and prevent breast cancer, prostate cancer, things of that sort. And it kind of got me into my initial love was kind of health policy and things of that sort. And, you know, he gave me jobs over the summer and did all kinds of stuff that helped me kind of get into that field. It was a lot of fun.
Let's talk about your favorite books. What are some of your favorite books? Be they fiction, nonfiction, investing related, whatever you enjoy reading. You mentioned books.
I only read nonfiction now.
Isn't that terrible? I'm the same way, and I miss fiction from my childhood.
You know, it's funny. I never was a big fiction reader growing up.
Science fiction and never got into that.
Not really. I mean, I read a few of them here and there,
Tolkien,
but I was never into it. Yeah.
Nothing.
No. I truth be told, this is terrible to say publicly, but I was not a reader growing up at all. I hated reading, and in fact, I'll never forget this. Hopefully, my college teachers aren't listening, but when I was applying to college, you know, after my junior year of high school, I got the applications, and I was applying. Actually, Harvard was one of the schools I applied to. I did not get in, by the way. And, you know, it said, tell us about the last three books you've read. And, you know,
I'm out.
That was one of the essay questions. Well, no, it wasn't. I said, oh, my God, I've got to go read three books. So I read three books that summer. Those are the only three books I read. And
really?
I wrote about them. Yeah.
Oh, God. Between Vonnegut and books were great in high school.
Yeah.
And then college, the problem with college is they want you to read books that for a purpose as opposed for pleasure. So,
I love nonfiction stuff. So, like, one of my favorite books is Master of the Senate, which is, you know, the book about Lyndon Johnson.
Huh.
I think that's really cool.
Is that Robert Caro?
Yes, it is Robert Caro. He's got that whole series. I think I've read all of them. Apparently,
they are immense.
Apparently, he's got one more coming out.
About how he does his work
process.
It's, it's supposed to be fabulous, but like 900 pages.
I was going to say, right, it's going to be 900 pages. And, you know, obviously he's, you know, he's not a young chicken anymore. And so he's got to get it done before.
Right. And he's, but his work is quite brilliant.
He's great. Yeah. I'm reading a book right now. I'm going to blank on the title about financial bubbles and speculation, which is really interesting. It's called Devil Take the Hindmost. Is a very
interesting
book. Yeah, it's an older book. It's actually I couldn't believe I hadn't read it, and I ran across it somewhere, and that's interesting. And I'll pick up some lighter stuff every now and then, but I generally tend to try
Edward Chancellor.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Pretty famous book.
Yeah, it's a good book. It's a very good book.
Give us one more.
One more that is exciting right now. What am I reading? The guy who runs the AEI Institute, I'm forgetting his name. He has a book out. It's actually called Love or Love Yourself or something like that. It's a very interesting book about kind of, you know, it's a book about modern politics and about how, you know, kind of bifurcated, obviously, we've all become. And this concept of, you know, his general view is, look, you know, it's a lot of this is breakdown of human relationships.
So I got a copy of it. Have you read it yet, or
I'm kind of like 25 pages in.
All right, so I got a review copy of it, okay. And I recognize his name. And the pitch is, we need to love each other more, and we need to be more involved. And I'm thinking, wait a second, AEI, you're the guys who said the pores caused the crisis. This was all the fault of, you know, first we did anti-redlining and that.
Right.
And this whole thing about it was the black and brown people's fault.
Right.
Wait, now you're pivoting to maybe
this is his swan song. So the story, as you may know, right, is he's quitting AI after.
That I didn't know.
So, yeah, he's been there 10 years. It's terrible. I can't remember his name. I apologize.
You'll probably find it.
So he is leaving AI after 10 years. In fact, he had a really interesting...
Arthur Brooks,
exactly.
Right.
That's
so
his name. Yeah.
So when I got this from my editor here, I said, you don't mind if I, you know, remove this guy's intestines and jump rope with it? Because that's after how divisive...
Yeah.
So there's a whole other thing that in the old days, think tanks used to be think tanks.
Right.
And now they've become these partisan idea shops and policy shops. So like, wait, after a... two decades of sheer partisan rancor, you're going to tell me you now want everybody to hold hands and sing Kumbaya?
Exactly.
Right? And I can't say what I want to say on the radio, but
I have not
read it.
So anyways.
But if you read it and you like it, I want you to get back to me and say.
I'm early on. So
I'm glad somebody I know is reading it.
I'll give you the review. Truth be told, the reason I have it is because it was a freebie at a conference I was at. So I might not have seen it otherwise. But
that's kind of
interesting. But I actually saw him speak.
See, I'm more concerned about the cost of the book than my time commitment to read it. Because it's 10 or 12 hours that you'll...
Yeah.
Like, and I've learned, I'm going to share one thing with you.
Yeah.
I've learned that when you start a book and you don't like it, just put it away. And
oh, you know, I was just going to say that. That is somebody actually
took a long time to get to that.
Chris Dixon, one of my partners, told me that, and boy, that's the most liberating thing I've ever heard. I agree.
Oh,
I never would do that. I would do the forced march through the books.
The baton death march through the last 100 pages.
It is
pages.
So liberating to say, okay, look, like I think I got it, and I think I understand the point, and you know, or you know, let me skip a couple pages here and there.
Right.
Now, nobody should skip my book, of course. I
got
to
go
read every word. Right.
From start to finish, you got to plow your way right through it. what VC influenced your approach to venture investing?
Yeah, so we've had probably one of the most interesting ones was a guy named Andy Ratcliffe, who was actually one of the founders of Benchmark.
Name.
You know Andy?
Okay,
so,
sure. I don't know him.
Yeah, so Andy
was
a longtime venture
familiar.
Guy. He
uh-huh.
was at a firm called Merrill Pickard, actually, which is where a bunch of the Benchmark team spun out. And
mm-hmm.
Andy was a little bit more on the enterprise side, so he did a bunch of their enterprise investing. But he was actually... he was the original investor in LoudCloud and Opsware, and so I just got to know him through that process. And I have a few references to him
in the book.
In the book there, but you know, his famous thing that he talked about at Benchmark was this concept of markets versus teams, and you know, basically he's got you know his view is look, which I think is true is you know good markets always beat good teams, or I should say bad markets always beat good teams. You know, obviously, you know, good teams can, you know, they can survive in a bad market, but will never likely kind of get there.
All right. Now we're going to do the speed round because they need to take you to wherever you're going next.
Okay.
Tell us about a time you failed and what you learned from the experience.
Yeah. Probably my most high profile failure was actually when I was applying to schools. I desperately wanted to go to Stanford coming out of school and was flatly rejected, as I was at Harvard, as I mentioned.
Oh, really?
And,
but you ended up going to Stanford.
I did end up going. So I went to Penn, actually, for 1 year out here on the East Coast,
and then,
I transferred. Yeah, but it was a, you know, disheartening.
There's a little persistency.
Then, exactly. There's some persistence, right?
What do you do for fun when you're not in the office or home reading books?
Yeah, I like to run. I've always liked to run. I used to be a marathoner, but kind of had to hang up mm-hmm. those shoes before. But
knees,
I still like
hips, ankles, what is it?
You name it. All those things, you know. and then I like... playing guitar. I'm not very good at it, but mm-hmm. I've been a country music fan for a long time. So.
Interesting. Our final two questions. A young millennial comes to you and says they're interested in a career in either venture capital or technology. What sort of advice would you give them?
Yeah, my best advice is go into a startup company. You don't have to start your own company, but learn the company building process. Don't go to venture. You know, you will be a much better venture capitalist having understood the company building process.
And my final question, what is it that you know about the world of investing today that you wish you knew 20 plus years ago?
Yeah, the biggest thing for me is I would have thought that most of the failure cases would be product or market failures.
Uh-huh.
And look, that happens sometimes. Look, sometimes the product just doesn't take or the market changes. The biggest thing that I found over the years we've been doing this is it's all about the team. And I know that sounds almost, you know, kind of, you know, comical to say, but
I thought you were going to say execution. So
embedded in that is execution, right? Mm-hmm. You know, are you hiring people at the right time? Are you thinking about your go-to-market the right way? Do you have the right cultural dynamic in the company? Those are the things, you know, when we look at the companies that go awry in a good market, it's almost always something like that.
Huh. Quite fascinating. We have been speaking with Scott Cooper. He is the managing partner at Andreessen Horowitz, now running $10 billion. If you enjoy this conversation, well, be sure and come back and check out all our previous such conversations. You can look Up an Inch or Down an Inch on Apple iTunes or wherever your finer podcasts are sold and see any of our previous 250 such conversations. We love your comments, feedback, and suggestions. Be sure to write to us at mibpodcast@bloomberg.net. Leave a review for us on Apple iTunes. You can check out my daily column on bloomberg.com/opinion or follow me on Twitter @Ritholtz. I would be remiss if I did not thank the crack staff that helps put this together each week. Michael Boyle is my producer/booker. Atika Valbrun is our project manager. Michael Batnick is my head of research. I'm Barry Ritholtz. You've been listening to Masters in Business on Bloomberg Radio.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.